If you keep Numbers 26, 27 open in front of you, sorry that I couldn't deliver it last week. I did think about sitting in a chair doing it, but it probably wouldn't have quite worked. But in God's goodness, it's worked out this week. As a culture, we've moved from what could be described as a moral culture to what is called a culture of emotion. It's quite easy to understand. If you think of the word good, and in a culture of a moral culture, the word good is defined in terms of right and wrong. In a culture of emotion, it's defined by good is what makes me feel happy. Bad is what makes me feel sad. And if you take that kind of culture and you apply it to a word such as faithfulness, and you take that concept of faithfulness into marriage, to an immoral culture, the word faithfulness in marriage, you do what is right, you uphold your promises, your vows. In a culture of emotion, faithfulness in marriage is, well, I'll be faithful until, whilst I'm feeling happy. But if I'm feeling sad, if the marriage isn't quite what feels right for me, well, then I'll leave, I won't be faithful. Culture of emotion. And the problem is when you live in a culture of emotion as we do, you sometimes can apply those kind of ideas and thinking to how God is. So you think of God faithful. In a culture of emotion, that means, well, God is faithful as long as he's happy with me, or he's sad with me, or he'll treat me on a whim, or however he's feeling at the moment. And of course, the Bible thinks of God as faithfulness in the sense of a moral, a rightness. God is faithful to his promises. He's faithful to his word. He'll do what is right. He'll uphold his promises and word. He's faithful. And Numbers 26 and Numbers 27 kind of underline that meaning of faithfulness, that he's utterly faithful. See, the first thing we see in chapter 26 is God's faithful in his preservation of his people and promises. God's faithful in his preservation of his people and promises. Numbers 26 marks a shift in the book of Numbers. It's a new beginning. It's episode 4 of Star Wars. It's a new hope. The second generation are here. The end, the plague at the end of chapter 25 has seemed to have brought about the kind of death of the rest of the first generation. And with that, Moses, or God, commands Moses and Eleazar, verse 1, to take a census of the whole Israelite community by families, all those 20 years old or more, who were able to serve in the army of Israel. So just as they've done in chapter 1, they've taken the census of the first generation, now they do it again. At the beginning of the second generation. So each tribe is listed. And this time also by clan. And we'll see why that is important in a minute. And the number is given as the census is taken. And the total recorded, verse 51, is 601,730. And then the Levites are then numbered as well. And they, verse 62, number 23,000. And then we read verse 63. These are the ones counted by Moses and Eleazar the priest when they counted the Israelites on the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho. Not one of them was among those counted by Moses and Aaron the priest when they counted the Israelites in the desert of Sinai. For the Lord has told these Israelites they would surely die in the desert, and not one of them was left, except Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, son of Nun. Now, what is remarkable about the total number of Israelites is that it's only 1,820 less than the first generation. So the second generation totals 601,730. The first generation, 603,550. The Levites number now 23,000. They previously had numbered 22,000. Now, why is that significant? Apart from those who are mathematicians and statisticians and the Bible reaching out to those types of people. You know, why is it important? because it demonstrates God's utter faithfulness to preserve his people. It demonstrates God's utter faithfulness to preserve his people. The whole first generation has died, but the numbers are still pretty much the same. In spite of all that has happened, and the census kind of gives us a hint of some of the things that have happened. So have a look at verses 8 to 11 of chapter 26, and we see and read that the sons of Pula were Eliab, and the sons of Eliab were Nimuel, Dathan, and Abram, and the same Dathan and Abram who had rebelled against Moses with the sons of Korah, and all of them, remember the incident, were swallowed up in the ground for their rebellion against Moses and against Aaron. And they were dead. And in spite of all of these kind of things happening, this judgment, in spite of the first generation's disobedience, in spite of the seduction by the Midianites and the Moabites, in spite of the people's own grumbling and disobedience and infighting, in spite of all that has happened, God has preserved a people. He's preserved a people from Egypt that he's taken out and he's kept. The number's the same, give or take 1,000. God has preserved a people. And this count here as well is not only to show us that he's preserved his people, but he's preserving his promise. Because the second census, unlike the first was about counting just the kind of the fighting men. This time the second census does that, but it also is significant, and the reason why they're in the clans is so that the land can be allocated. See verse 52? The Lord said to Moses, this land is to be allotted to them as an inheritance, based on the number of names or clans. And then two explanations are then given for how the land is to be divided. First, it's to be done on the basis of the count. So the smaller tribes receive the smaller portions, the larger tribes receive the larger portions, verse 54. But the Lord also makes it clear to Moses that the lot should be drawn to divide the land as well, verse 55. Now, how those two things work together, we're not quite sure, but imagine something like lots were cast, the tribes were allocated according to the lots cast, a particular spot in the land, and then kind of once that was allocated, they then kind of worked out the size that was required for that particular tribe. It was both practical and it was fair. But actually, that's not the main thing. How the land was allotted is not the main thing. The main thing is that it's been allotted. It's that the Lord is giving the land to his people that he has preserved in its totality. And five times in those verses, 52 to 56, we're told it's an inheritance. In other words, it's a gift. In other words, it is given to them. The Lord kind of underlines it. I'm giving this as an inheritance to you, as a gift. It's yours. It's your land. I'm giving it to you. The Lord is giving them this land to this people that he's preserved in spite of all that has happened, in spite of the judgments, in spite of the disobedience, in spite of the grumblings, in spite of the seduction from Moabites and Midianites, in spite of fighting with Og and Sihon, in spite of all these things. God has remained faithful and preserved his people and preserved his promise to give them a land. It's an overwhelming demonstration of God's grace and faithfulness. People didn't do anything to deserve any of this. In fact, God could have justly destroyed them. I mean, think back to Exodus 32 when the golden calf incident comes down. And what does God want to do? He wants to wipe out the whole of the Israelites. And Moses pleads. And God says, look, I could still remain faithful to my promises to Abraham. I could just raise up generations from stones for them. But God remains faithful and keeps his promises and preserves this people to give them a land. In his grace, he is faithful. And of course, the reality is, we're an undeserving people. And like the Israelites, we've been saved. And like the Israelites, we too at times grumble and disobey and infight, and we're seduced by the world, the Midianites and the Moabites, as we saw the other week. In truth is, if it was down to us, none of us would enter the land, would we? None of us would be kept if it was down to you, if it's down to me. And yet, praise God, it's all of him. It's him that is faithful, not us. I was trying to think of a way to illustrate it, and all I could come up with is, it's like aeroplanes. Okay, you're going to have to work with me on this. It's an aeroplane, and in faith you get on an aeroplane, and you put your faith in an aeroplane and the pilot. And you get on that plane, and what happens? You take a seat, and the pilot begins to talk with you and communicate with you, and he says to you, you know, fasten your seatbelt and don't get up at this point and do what the stewards do. And what happens on the flights? Well, there are some in the cabin, some don't put their seatbelt on when they're supposed to, and they walk around or they don't walk around, and turbulence comes and they hurt themselves. And there's others in the cabin who are grumbling and a little bit unhappy with the service and the food and the drink. And there's others who are kind of just infighting in the front of the plane. We won't go to the back of the plane, but the front of the plane, they're having a little fight. And all of these things are happening in this plane, which you're all putting your faith in the plane and in the pilot. And of course, what's happening the whole time? There's disobedience, there's grumbling, there's fighting, but that plane is going from A to B. And is that not like us? Our faith is in Christ, in him alone, what he's done. And there are times when I grumble, and there's times when I fight, and there's times when I disobey. And yet, because I'm in him, I get to the land. Because he's faithful to his promises, and he's faithful to preserve his people. And isn't that a great comfort? Isn't that a great comfort on Tuesday morning when actually you realise you've blown it again for the umpteenth time? You've shouted at the children or the dog or kicked the dog. I've not kicked mine yet. And you realise that if it was down to you, you'd never get there. But it's down to him, by faith in him, because he's faithful. Even when I'm unfaithful. See, Numbers 26 shouts loud and clear that God is faithful in his preservation of his people and his promises to give them a land and have a people. And that promise is still true for us. And yet, what's our response to be? Our response is to be a people living by faith. Chapter 27, verses 1 to 11, we see a story of the five daughters of Zelophehad. And Graham's already said the name, so I don't need to. And this story sits in between God's faithfulness, seen in preserving his people, and God's faithfulness, seen in providing a leader, Joshua, in verse 12 to 23 at the end of 27. So sandwiched in between these two stories of God's faithfulness is this, well, story of about five daughters. And you're kind of thinking, what's the point? Is this kind of a red herring, like I used to do in my economics class with Mr. Mullins? You know, you just needed to tell him a little bit about hockey, and that was a good 10, 15 minutes wasted of the economics lesson. That might explain why I failed economics. But that's another story. Is it one of those? No. Actually, this is a really significant story, because what we're beginning to see is that this second generation are a faith-filled people. They're faithful, unlike the first generation. And we saw a hint of it the other week in the actions of Phineas. Do you remember the story of Phineas in the midst of the Midianite and Moabite seduction? He finds Cosby and Zimri literally having sex in the tent of meeting. And he acts in faith in order to enact God's judgment upon them. And we know that's the case because Psalm 106, verse 31, says to us that it was credited to him as righteousness. Just as Abraham was credited with righteousness, why? Because he had faith, so Phineas, in faith, killed in judgment Cosby and Zimri, because he had faith in God's good, just purposes. We're getting the hint that this second generation are a faith-filled people. And now we see five daughters acting in faith because they want to be part of the inheritance. They understand that the great prize to be laid hold of by faith is the land that God has promised. And it's by faith, because you can't earn the land, you can't pay for the land. No one could. It's a gift, it's an inheritance, but it's even more so for them, because the law dictated that only sons received an inheritance. And dear old Zelophehad had no sons, only daughters. And so Zelophehad's share would go to another, his name would disappear, and these daughters, not wanting to miss out on the great prize, the inheritance, not because they just wanted a piece of land, but because they recognize what the land represented. It meant you were part of God's people, that you were blessed by him. And so they go by faith, verse 2, and present themselves to the tent of meeting. And we see the national and spiritual importance of it as they stand before Moses and Eleazar, the high priest, and all the kind of leaders and a whole assembly. And in many ways, the issue is quite straightforward. Their father, Zelophehad, died in the wilderness, as did all the parents of that generation. But he has five daughters and no sons. Therefore, they could not get the inheritance. But more than that, and importantly, he was not one of the Korah rebels, because had he belonged to that rebellion, he would have forfeited all rights to the inheritance. But he died for his own sin, and his only problem is that he's got daughters, not sons. And so the daughters request, verse 4, why should our father's name disappear from his clan? Because he had no son. Give us property among our father's relatives. In other words, please include us in the count of chapter 26, which is used to divide up the land. And such a request sounds a little presumptuous to us, especially in our English translations. It sounds like our children, when they come and Aunt Mabel's got a big box of chocolates and they say, give it to us, and you, as parent, cringe. But actually here we discover, verse 6, that God's response shows that they were right to behave this way. Verse 6, verse 7, what Zelophehad's daughters are saying is right. You must certainly give them property as an inheritance among their father's relatives, and turn their father's inheritance over to them. In fact, they were so right, they were so grasped the importance of the land, that in many ways it changed the inheritance laws to a degree. Yes, the law still dictated that it went to the sons, but if there were no sons, now it could go to the daughters. And if there was no offspring at all, then the land would go to a brother, and thereafter to uncles, and thereafter to the nearest relative, to ensure that this land stayed within the family. It remained that they were still part of God's people. These daughters are faith-filled. They want to be part of God's promises, to be part of the inheritance. And so by faith, they approach the one who gives, and he gives them their inheritance. Faith-filled servants know that it's the Lord who gives the inheritance. You cannot earn their portion of the land. And these daughters know this. And so they demonstrate faith by laying hold of what their parents' generation had casually thrown away. Hebrews 11, verse 1 says, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. And unlike the previous generations, who in fact had a taster of the land, hadn't they? They'd seen the great clusters of grapes come out. They'd seen the goodness of the land. They'd heard the spies report of this land flowing with milk and honey. And yet they'd rejected it. They'd favored a return back to Egypt. But these five women, by faith, hope for and are certain of what is to come, such that they're prepared to live in light of what is to come. And so they boldly approach Moses and the leaders, and they request their share, because they desperately, by faith, want the inheritance. They're like the man who Jesus talks about, the man who came along and he found the great white pearl, and he sold everything in order to have that pearl. Or the man who was walking in a field and found treasure and went home and sold everything in order to buy the field, in order to have the treasure. Because he desperately wanted the inheritance. These daughters are faith-filled. And they live in light of that faith. Doing what is necessary to grasp what was theirs. They're different to the first generation. They're living by faith, looking forward to what is to come, and then they're living in light of it. See, faith is not just something you think. It's something you live. It's an investment of your life. Like these women, they acted and lived by faith in light of the prize. Faith is a response of your heart to God that completely alters the way you live. You don't just think by faith, you live by faith. You have to act in light of it. And like these women. And yet so often we don't. So often actually we act like the first generation who stood in awe of the prize of the land and its fruitfulness, but then didn't live in light of it. I mean, pretend you're standing with me on the Brighton Pier and you're hearing the waves crashing and you get that nice smell of the candy floss mingled with the fish and chips. And we're standing there looking at the twinkly, sparkly lights. And right at the end of the pier is, well, it's an amusement arcade thing which is supposed to bring fun and pleasure. But it looks like a human catapult. Have you seen it? It's kind of just, Tom's probably been on it. You know, he kind of just swings around like this. And you stand in awe as you watch kind of normally sane human beings strap themselves into this thing and then kind of just get flung out 50 feet up in the air across the English Channel. Now you can stand there with me and we can look in awe at this catapult flying people out across the English Channel. But I ain't going to put my faith in that thing. And same way. See, we can be amazed by God's faithfulness. And yet not live by faith. See, we can be amazed by heaven and what is to come and not live by faith. I can be amazed by the grace of the cross of Jesus and not live by faith. See, I can stand and praise God on a Sunday. And yet come Tuesday, I disobey. I don't want to live. My faith has no bearing on my workplace or my home. But faith-filled people live in light of the promise. And so it shapes how, not just what they do on a Sunday, but what happens on a Monday through to Saturday. Faith-filled people live in light of the promise, live in light of the cross, live in light of the resurrection. They live in light of the hope to come, and it shapes their money, and it shapes their time, and it shapes their priorities. Because faith is not just something I feel and think, it's something I do as well, I live out. The daughters of Zelophehad are a great example, because here are five women who have faith, and in faith they want the land, and in order to get the land they act on faith and go and ask for what is theirs. They live it out. And yet so often we're like the first generation. We stand in awe. But I don't live it. The faith I stand in awe of doesn't shape what I do through the week. Or it just touches it maybe just ever so slightly. See, if I was living in light of what is to come, then isn't that going to affect how I spend my money and use my money? I'm not going to be worried too much, am I? I'm going to use my time for the glory of God, for the purposes of others to be with me, because I believe there's a greater place to come. It's going to shape what I do and what I say and how I speak to people, isn't it? Faith-filled people live it out. The question is, are you a faith-filled person? Are you living in light of the faith? Or are you just standing in awe, but not actually getting strapped in? See, the people are faith-filled. It's a new generation. It's a new beginning. But it's the same old faithful God. See, thirdly and finally, we see God is faithful in his provision of a leader. See, not only has God preserved his people and his promise, he now provides a new leader for this new beginning. New change, new leader. It's a bit like when... Was it Neil Kinnock that Tony Blair took over from, or was it John Smith? I couldn't quite remember. But at that point, isn't it, when Blair takes over from Kinnock, I think. Smith takes over from Kinnock.
Yeah.
Okay. And what is significant is that point, isn't it, whether he takes over from Smith or Kinnock, is that effectively it's a new start. Blair kind of represents new Labour. This was old Labour, now we have new Labour. It's a new generation, a new leader. And that's what you're seeing here with Joshua. This is a new start, it's a new generation. Moses represents the first generation. He belongs to the first generation. He will not enter the promised land because he's not honoured God as holy, verse 14. Oh, it's a different reason from the rest of his generation, but still he will die in the wilderness like them. And yet God in his grace allows Moses to see the new land, verse 12, a reward for his faithfulness. Some commentators take it that God is going, hey, Moses, look at the land, see what you could have had. No, which just doesn't seem right to me. I think he's saying, here's a reward. You're seeing the land, you're seeing what your people have and where you have been. And with all that happening, Moses recognizes, understandably, the end is near, and he pleads with the Lord to provide, to appoint a new leader. And he asked that one who is both a warrior, one who would lead them out and bring them in, verse 17, and one who is a pastor, that is, that the people may not be a sheep and have no shepherd. And the appointment of Joshua is not a foregone conclusion. Caleb could have been chosen, but God makes clear Joshua is indeed the man of God's choosing. And so verse 18, take Joshua, son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hands on him. And laying on of hands does not impart the Spirit. The Spirit's already in him, verse 18, but it does signify the transfer of leadership from Moses to Joshua. And yet there is a significant difference in the ministry, however. See, verse 20, firstly, Joshua will only have some of Moses' authority. Not all. He won't quite be like Moses. And secondly, and more significantly, he'll require Eleazar to inquire on his behalf using the Urim. Unlike Moses, who spoke face to face with God, Joshua is not going to be able to do that. He's going to have to use the high priest. And the question is why? Why do the people not get a leader as good as Moses? I mean, when you look at it, isn't it, that God has been faithful to his promises, he's preserved his people. The second generation looked like they're a greater, more faith-filled people than the first generation. So why do they not have a leader equal to at least Moses? And I think the answer is because this isn't the end, is it? Yeah, there are faith-filled people. Yes, God is preserving his people and promises to enter the land, but this isn't the land. And Joshua isn't the leader. It's just a shadow. We're meant to see that actually, even though God is being faithful to this generation, there is still something more to come. There is one greater to come. It's not a surprise, is it, that we then read of Jesus centuries later looking at a crowd harangued and harassed. And in Matthew 9, verse 36, we read, he has compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. The very thing Moses had prayed would not be the case becomes the case until, of course, the good shepherd himself comes. One who will be greater than Moses, greater than Joshua. One who will be a warrior, who will lead his people out and bring them in. He will lead them out from sin and he will bring them into the land. A warrior who will defeat not just the enemies of a land, but he will defeat all enemies. So we read Colossians 2:15, how on the cross he defeats all enemies. Because he's the greatest warrior. And we read, of course, that in John 10, he is the good shepherd who cares for his people and leads his people. He is the one who leads them to the pastures green. And of course, he's greater than Moses. Moses didn't enter the land. He died. Jesus died, not for his sin, but for our sin. And he rose again, and he then leads us into the land. See, as we come to the close of Numbers 27, and we see God's provision of a leader, what we're left with is wanting that greater leader, and in Jesus we find that greater leader. The one who will be a warrior and a shepherd, one who will take his people and lead his people and bring them into the land safe and secure. Isn't that what you and I need? On that Tuesday morning when I've mucked up again and shouted at the kids and kicked the dog for the 9th time that morning, then I need to look to a leader who in faith I can place and trust that he'll be able to lead me into the land, who will be my warrior, who will be my shepherd. That's what Numbers 26, 27 sings and shouts to us, isn't it? God is faithful to his people. Even today, thousands of years later, same faithful God, a God who preserves, a God who keeps his promises, a God who provides a leader that we need. And our response? To be like the daughters of Zelophehad, faith-filled, seeking to live in light of our faith. Spend a moment just pondering those truths, allowing and praying that the Spirit would convict you where you need to be convicted or encouraged, challenged.